So subsequent to tonight's meeting, Alan will post the deck, the chat, when the contents of the chat window and the audio recording of the deck to the website. So if you want to pick up any of that later on, it will be there probably later on this evening. And so with that, I think I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through the deck. If we have Alan. Alan is
Alan unmutes his microphone. We can do that, yes. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, thanks very much, Chris, and welcome everyone. I guess we don't need to remind Chris of anything because he's remembered everything he needs to do. Okay, in the chat window, it tells you that we have a limited amount of material tonight, a few interesting topics, I think, but all of which Chris and I have provided. So if you have any questions that you want to ask or things that you want to share, we're going to have lots of time, I think, at the end of this prepared deck. So to start off with, I'll let Chris give you a reminder about this.
Yeah, so as all of you on the call, I'm sure, are aware, we've been pounding the pavement a little bit on this, the 2021 member survey on member settings. So this is all really stems from the idea that we know at some point the church is going to welcome us back if we want to go back to in-person meetings. And so we wanted to gauge a number of issues around that. And so if you have not filled out the survey, all are encouraged to fill it out. It only takes about 5 minutes. And we even encourage non-members to fill it out as well. If you are a non-member, we do request that you put that fact into the comment box at the end of the survey. So get to it within the next couple of days, and we're going to be starting working on the analysis portion. Well, we, Linda will be starting working on the analysis portion of it a couple of days from now. So if you haven't filled it out, please do so.
Okay, fine. Thanks. Thanks for that, Chris. And I have a couple of reminders too. I haven't reminded people about our Google Groups for quite a long time. I'm sure most of our members will know all about it. I haven't checked the list to see tonight if we have any non-members on the call. But we do have a number of groups which can be quite useful. The first one is the announcements list. And if you received a message about 3/4 of an hour ago, then you are subscribed to the announcements list, and you'll get the occasional notice like that telling you of interesting things that are happening with the club. The next newsletter, our monthly newsletter, we take a hiatus over the summer, but the September issue will come out next month in kind of mid to late August. And we do have a subscription service for that. So if you subscribe to the OPCUG newsletter Google group, you can get the newsletter sent directly to you by email, and it will arrive as a full-color PDF file with hot links to any URLs that are included in the text. And finally, if you are a member, and you enjoy the question and answer sessions, then you should be subscribed to the member forum, because that gives you the opportunity to have a 24/7, 365 question and answer session. You can post questions on the forum, and it's almost certain that somebody is going to give you an answer. So the URL there tells you how to subscribe to all of those things, so feel free if you haven't done so already. And finally, on the reminder thing, past sessions for the question and answer session are available. We post, as Chris mentioned, we post the PowerPoint decks as PDF files. The chat window goes up as a text file. And with the audio recording, which Chris remembered to start, and it goes up as an audio file. And so you can download the ones from tonight, probably, as Chris says, later tonight. I just have to wait for Zoom to process the files and make them available to me, but generally that's done within an hour or so. But if you're interested in things that we've done previously, then you can look at a couple of different things. If you go to the Q&A page, you'll find this graphic partway down the page now with a couple of links, one to our list of past topics, so you can see the various things that we've covered in the past, and they are linked back to the specific recordings. And of course, the recordings themselves are available as downloads, basically listed chronologically. So those two pages will get you to archives of the question and answer sessions. Okay, so that's all the reminder type stuff, and now we go to a share from Chris.
One more thing. Can we turn on live transcript?
I turned it off in the settings in our Zoom account. The only comments we got were ones of annoyance about it, and we had gotten nothing saying that people actually wanted the live transcript, so I turned off the setting in our account.
This is your share, Chris.
Yeah, so I came across this the other day. TechSoup Canada is a site that helps out nonprofits with links to discounted products with various vendors and so forth. So they send out emails periodically, and they came up with this one, which I thought was a little bit interesting. It was a UK-based study that talked about the cost of email. And so when you talk about the cost of an email, we're not talking about the time it takes you to read it and you could be doing more productive things, making money or whatever. We're actually talking about the cost of server storage and electricity to run routers and air conditioning in the data center and disk drives and all the rest of it. And so this study came up and said that if every UK adult sent one fewer email a day, it would save 16,433 tons of carbon a year. I'm always suspicious about these numbers, but you know, they say that's the equivalent of 81,000 flights from London to Madrid or taking more than 3,000 diesel cars off the road. Again, I sort of wonder a little bit about it, but they did point to the Carbon Literacy Project, which I've pasted in the information of the chat on this as well. So you can read a little bit more on it. And there is the TechSoup article at the bottom there, greening our carbon footprint, check your email. And so if you're interested in this sort of thing, some things that you can check out.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. I have a short follow-up on the issue of Audacity. You remember that I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, I think. Audacity is a open source sound editing program, and it had been obtained by a company called Muse Group, and they had changed the privacy policy that allowed them to collect data from users using online telemetry. And typically open source people take great exception to programs that do that. And because it's open source, it means that programmers can take the source code, modify it, and republish it as something else. And a user called Cookie Engineer had done exactly that. He'd taken the source code, he stripped all the telemetry out of it, and then published it on GitHub. And one of the things he did was he surveyed the open source community for a project name. They couldn't use Audacity because that's a trade name owned by this Muse Group. So they needed a new name, and so he put out a survey, and this group of nebulous characters, I don't know anything about these people, it's a group called 4chan, it seems to be, it's an anonymous forum, and they seem to have a poor reputation, shall we say, charitably, amongst this open source community. They basically hijacked the survey, just like they're going to with the OPCUG member survey, I'm sure. They hijacked the survey, and everybody, all their people put in these this name, and they wanted it called Sneed City. Now, if you're a Simpsons fan, This may mean something to you. Apparently, Snead has got something to do with The Simpsons, and so they wanted to rename Audacity as Snead City. Cookie Engineer and his group didn't really like that, so they rejected the survey. It was their survey. It wasn't binding. They were just asking for suggestions, I think. So they rejected Snead City and decided that they would call the new program Tenacity. Well, that let loose a whole bunch of harassment online to Cookie Engineer. He was getting all kinds of harassing type messaging. And even somebody showed up at his apartment with a knife. And he apparently got cut or stabbed or something. He reported it to the police clearly, but he wasn't terribly thrilled. So he has now stepped down as the main person who will develop the new version of Audacity. And so for now, at least, there are different forks progressing. Tenacity is continuing on GitHub. And there's also this, these people from 4chan have developed a fork too, and they've kept the name Snead City. So there are going to be open source options without the telemetry eventually, and we'll see how that continues. In the meantime, there's nothing wrong with using an old version of Audacity because that doesn't include any telemetry, so there are no privacy concerns with it. But if you're interested in a different kind of program, I was looking on the web and I found this review by somebody in Review Geek, and the best Audacity alternatives. And looking through them, one that kind of stood out to me is called Olsen Audio. It's a cross-platform program. It supports Windows and Linux and also the Mac OS. And it's reputedly very similar to Audacity. It's also open source, I believe. So it could be a pretty drop-in replacement for Audacity, although there's probably a learning curve there because no doubt the look and feel on the control system is somewhat different, but I'm sure it has similar features. So it's probably just a question of getting used to the new user interface on this thing. I haven't tried it personally yet. If anybody does and wants to report back to us, I think that would be most welcome. Anyway, that's the story of Audacity to date, as far as I know.
I think it could be interesting, too, if people do start following the forks that are coming out from Audacity. It'd be interesting if we could hear anything about what forks seem to be successful and what ones are actually adding interesting features rather than just getting rid of telemetry. That could all be very interesting for anybody who's doing recording.
Yeah, okay. So moving on, Chris has an interesting share, I think.
Yeah, this was kind of cool, actually. I came across this site about compressing PDF files. So I guess my interest in compressing PDF files goes back to some problems that we were having with the newsletter, and Bridget was having some of the newsletters were creating huge PDF files, multi-megabyte, and it was getting to be a problem emailing them as well as even just posting them in the forum. And so I did some work at the time about, you know, looking at the images that were in the PDF files, compressing them individually, and so forth to try to get the overall PDF file down to a more manageable size. Also, using different programs to generate PDF files would create dramatically different sizes of resulting files. So PDF files can be really large, in particular if you have graphics in the file, large graphics, high-resolution graphics in the file. The PDF file itself can get really quite large. So Compressed PDF is a service. It's one of many services that are available from a site called Small PDF. And I found that it compresses PDF files by generally between about 40% to 60%, and I had some that went outside of that, but most of them fell within that. And so that's pretty decent in terms of compressing it. There's some artifacting that will happen on the images for sure, but I found that for, by and large, it was not too bad. So it's a service. It's online. You don't have to download software or anything like that. You basically upload your PDF file to it. It compresses it. You download the results, and off you go. So next slide. So here's some examples of what I did. This was a shipping label that was sent to me by Rogers to send some equipment back to them. So that what you see in the top right-hand corner is actually an 8.5 by 11 page. And so it came to me as a PDF file. It was already a PDF file, and it was 131,000 bytes. So not all that large. But when I fed it through this program to do the compression, it ended up down to 15,000 bytes, so it was 88% compression on this particular file. And if you look at, I highlighted in the top right-hand corner in red, one portion of it that I show in the main part of the slide at its original one-to-one size, 100%. And if you look at it right there, you know, they both look pretty good. But if you blow them up a little bit, you'll see that there is some artifacting. So this is viewing at 400%. It's still not bad, but you definitely see some speckling. You see some jaggies on the edge characters and things like that. So you're going to get this with this solution, is you're going to get some artifacting going on your images, unquestionable. But to me, depending on the use it's being put to, it may not be of any consequence whatsoever. Sorry?
For things like this, for images and so on like that, I find that I usually create a PNG, a 2-bit PNG in Irfan view, and when I save it, it's tiny.
Yeah, there's lots of solutions to compress your images before you create your PDF file, but this is useful in two circumstances that I can really think of. One is when you just don't want to bother with going through that trouble. And secondly is when you get a PDF file that is actually given to you, or you download a PDF file, you don't want to break it apart and put it back together smaller. You can just compress the file and get some savings that way. So going back to the idea of the OPC-UG newsletter, I took one of our newsletters, which was the June issue, which I pulled up here. So the original file was 1.5 megabytes, and the compressed file was about 0.5 megabytes. So we got about 66% or two-thirds compression out of it, which is pretty decent. And you can see this one photo, which took up, what I guess, about a sixth of the page. You look at the original at 100% and the compressed at 100%, and they both look pretty decent. So for the purposes that this article in the newsletter was all about, you know, I don't think too much was lost. If we actually enlarge them and view them at 400%, you really do start to see the artifacting going on in the image. But again, depending on the purpose that you're putting this to, it may not be of any consequence to have that level of compression and artifacting going on. And to be able to save two-thirds space on disk space, that's pretty significant. And when you're downloading them off of our website, things like that, you might appreciate the fact that they're compressed by 66%.
A couple of questions, Chris. Yep. A question from Bill. Does the receiver have to have the program too?
No. Basically, what you're doing is you're taking a PDF file that is on your computer. You're uploading it to that service. You download the results, and then you do whatever you want with that file. So you can discard your original if you don't want it anymore, or if you want to share the compressed file with other people, you'll be sharing a smaller file than everybody else. They claim on their website that all files that are uploaded to their website are deleted within 1 hour. So they don't hang on to it. It just goes away.
And the second question was, that's a guess question. I suppose you had no problem scanning the barcode. I assume that means once it was reduced.
Yeah, I don't know. again, this was a PDF file that was just sent to me. I printed it stuck it on the box, and I sent it off. So it was just a PDF file that I happened to have lying around that I decided to try doing that. The artifacting probably would not have been significant enough to cause problems reading the barcode, but I can't say for sure. That's not how I actually use that. Okay, text and PDFs are totally unaffected. So if it's not, if the PDF file is not converting your text to an image and storing it that way, text in the PDF file will be totally unchanged in terms of its resolution. There's no artifacting that goes on and so forth. You can see here I had a one pager that I used for my Windows 10 Good, Bad, and the Ugly presentation. And I highlight a portion of it in the top left-hand corner of that page. And viewed even at 800%, the compressed looks identical to the original. Interestingly, and I can't remember what file, what program I used to compress the original file, was probably Microsoft Print to PDF. The original PDF file was 202K, and it compressed down to just under 100K. So 52% compression, and because it was all text, there's absolutely no change in quality on the PDF file whatsoever. So it was really kind of good.
Bill's asking, what if the PDF is a slideshow?
If the PDF is a slideshow, I'm not sure what is meant
by
that.
I think that means it's a multi-page PDF.
It'll compress all of the pages. So I did the eight-page newsletter. So I got back an 8-page PDF file. It was just, everything was just smaller. If you have other things that are embedded in it, I don't know what would happen in the case of, some other media type embedded in the PDF file. I suspect that it would just leave that portion of it, unchanged, but, you'd have to test it to really see. It's free service, so, you can try it out, and well, free service. We'll talk about that in just a moment. So, next slide. So, this site that is there has some additional functionality on it. So, again, the website is smallpdf.com, and one of the things they do have is that ability to compress PDF files. But they have other things you can do as well. And on screen, I have their edit function. So you can upload a PDF file and then go into this edit function. And then you can do things like freehand drawing, where you can put check mark on, or you can write, you know, with your mouse, or I've got a tablet, so I just write with my pen and put text in. You can change its size, you can change its color and so forth. You can add text boxes, and again, you can choose you know, what color it is, how big it is. I don't think you have an ability to choose the font on text. I can't remember, but I don't think you do. Highlighting, you can either highlight text where it will actually maintain the highlight will be the height of the text, and you drag it over and it highlights it just as if you were highlighting text with your mouse. It works the same sort of way. And again, you can choose the color that you want your highlighting. And you have a freehand highlighter where you can just scribble over top of something, and it has that translucent quality to it. And you can change the level of translucence on it as well. So you can go like, okay, I'll make this 10%. And it'll be very, very faint, or you can make it 90% where it's almost obscuring whatever it is you're highlighting. You can draw on various shapes. They have, you know, circles, ovals, boxes, all kinds of different shapes. And again, you can change the width of the border as well as the color of it. And you can also, once you've done it, you place something on, you click on it, and you can drag that item around or resize it and things like that. So it's really kind of nice. And then when you're done, basically you say, okay, and it'll create a PDF file for you. You download the PDF file, and it's exactly like you see on the screen right there with all of that stuff that's been added to it. Of course, unless you have something that can break it apart, you've lost the ability to edit those elements in the PDF file. But I'm not sure what would happen if you bring it into something that is a PDF editor I'm not sure how the objects that you've added will appear at that point in time. No clue at all.
I notice it does other things, Chris, like split and merge.
What's
this e-sign? You know what that one is?
No, I read a brief description of it, and it's the idea of putting a digital signature on something, but I don't know anything about it. I didn't try that. The split PDF in the free version is not great because all it allows you to do is split it, and I think you'll end up, you split off one page at a time. Is all you can do. So when you split, it'll ask you, do you want page one? You know, if you got an eight pager, it'll say, you can't say, give me eight separate pages. You can say, I want page one. I want page two. I want page three. The paid version, of course, no problem. You can do that. And the same with the merge is like, I didn't try the merge function at all. But I presume it's probably limited somewhat as well, in that you can probably only merge a couple of things together and just have to keep manual operations going. Which actually comes into the next slide, which is a little bit of what sucks about it. So it is a free service available. Which will only give you one level of compression. If you go for the paid service, you can have two levels of compression. So there's the one that is free, and there's a higher level of compression, which presumably gives you higher level of artifacting as well. You can only process two files per day. But it turns out that's per browser, which turns out that's because they do everything based on cookies. So if you delete your cookies, you can process as many files as you want all day long. So if you go in, for example, in Google Chrome, I could be sitting there on the site, go to Settings, Privacy and Security, Cookies and Other Site Data, see all cookies and site data, search for smallpdf.com, delete it, you go back to the website, and you say, I want to do a new file. And it says, okay, you've got two to do today. You know, or it tells you after you've done one, you said, you have used one of two. Now, I also tried in Chrome, you can actually block a site from creating cookies on your computer. And that actually works so that you don't have to go in and delete their cookie every time you create something. And it will just happily let you create, PDF after PDF after PDF. The one thing and why I didn't put that on the slide is that if you go into edit, you have to have cookies enabled for the site. Otherwise, you click on edit and the site just sits there and it does nothing. So if you don't want to edit PDFs, you just want to do the compression feature, then you can go into Google Chrome, block the site from creating cookies on your computer, and you can create them all day long. If you don't want to go in and delete cookies, if you have four browsers loaded on your computer, you can do eight a day, because you can do two per browser per day. And so fill your boots however you want to do on that. The pro account is expensive. So they have two plans, a monthly plan at $16 US per month, or you can do a yearly plan at $12 a month or $144 a year US, and that will open up all of their features, all of their editing tools, everything like that. So if you do an awful lot with PDF files, you might find it useful. They do have, I believe it's a 30-day trial of the Pro account. So you can go in, you can try out all of the expensive features, and just decide whether you want to keep it or not. I suspect it's one of those ones where you have to give them a credit card number at the start, and then if you don't cancel your account, it automatically starts billing on you. So just be aware of that. But I thought it was a pretty cool site, and for what it does, I think it does a decent job, and it's fast and easy to use.
Just to clarify, only one level of compression, that means that it decides which level it will use. You can get different levels of compression based on the file, but you don't get to choose
Yeah, that's right. It's a, I think it's what they call their medium compression or something like that, or standard compression. And you don't choose it. It just does what it's going to do. And it's free. If you don't like the results, yeah, move on, do something else.
But it, the level of compression depends on the file that you give it.
Well, I'm not sure. It definitely would. But I suspect that what they're doing is they're doing all your graphics. They are compressing them with a certain amount of, you know, JPEG compression, for example. So JPEG has the ability to save with, you know, a quality setting. And so they might be choosing 7 or something like that out of 10 right. of their compression level. It's not that they're randomly choosing, oh, okay, well, this picture will do at a compression level of 2 and this will do a compression level of 9. I think it's just, you know, they're doing one compression level on all of the graphics, I suspect is what they're doing. And you just get the results of that. And the different sizes of different files depends on what you handed them. So if some graphic will undergo a higher level of savings by doing this level of compression, then you'll see higher level results, I suspect is what it's really all about.
So for your examples, one of them had an 88% compression, the other one had 50% compression. But those were both with the free service.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they were not done with, I did nothing special. I have not created a pro account. And so that had to do with the original PDF file. I suspect that, the first one with that shipping label, it was probably created using a program that was very poor at trying to save space with a PDF file. And it wasn't created by me. It was created by Rogers. And so it just happened that however that was created, they had the ability to, you know, squeeze more out of it.
Okay, thanks, Chris. That was like a really neat little program.
Yeah.
Okay, I have a share based on the laser printers, and in particular the printer toner. A friend of mine gave me her HP laser printer because it wasn't working anymore. The toner light was on. And so I figured, well, maybe it just needs toner. So my question to everybody is, do you have a laser printer? I've used laser printers for a long time. I really like them. I've never used inkjets. But where do you buy toner from? Because typically if you buy the original equipment toner, it's rather expensive. You can get third-party products, but if you go to a big box store, and I'm thinking there of somebody like Staples, you may only save like $10 or $20 on the price of the cartridge. I've always gone to Canada Computers because they had toner for like $20 or $30 when the original was more like $90 or $100. But now when I look up for a couple of different printers, my friend's printer and my specific printer, and they basically don't have any stock. So, and there's no stock in the warehouse, there's no stock across the country, there's one here, three there. And so that suggests to me that Canada Computers aren't going to be selling toner for maybe older printers or something. But you can still go on online, and of course the classic is Amazon.ca. So, for example, for my friend's HP laser printer, she needs a Brother TN420. And at Staples, the OEM one is $65. So they do offer this third-party one by a company called Fusion that I've never heard of. But that's $52. So you're saving, you know, $10, $12 on the cost of a cartridge. If you go look up the same cartridge, TN420, on Amazon, you find that it's less than $20. It's $17, basically. Now, it's a company called Ink First, which seems to be an Amazon exclusive. I've never seen... They don't seem to have an Ink First website, as far as I can tell. But they're all over Amazon with printer cartridges for everybody. And that's for my friend's printer. For my printer, which is a Samsung, which is now owned by HP, Staples will sell me a brand new cartridge for $105. That Fusion third party one is $84, so I'm saving $20. But if I go to Amazon and buy one of these Ink First ones, or an equivalent one, it's a slightly different, it's a different manufacturer, but the same idea, it's a third party online cartridge, they're basically $20. So the upside is you get a much cheaper printer toner. The downside is, well, there's several downsides. When the box came for my friend's printer, there were no instructions on what to do, other than open the box to take the cartridge out. They didn't tell me how to put the printer toner into the actual printer. And then once I had it in the printer, I got a fuser error, which I had to resolve. And then once I got rid of the fuser error, the toner light, which is in the graphic here, that was the first problem we started with. It needed new replacement toner. Once I got rid of the fuser error, the toner light was still on, so it still wouldn't print. So how do we get around all of these things? Well, my option of choice is YouTube University. They know everything. So type in the name of the printer replacement toner cartridge. You get a little video, 2 minutes, and some third-party manufacturer tells you, you press that little green button in the bottom left-hand corner, you can pull the cartridge out, drop the other one in, and you're basically done. And the only reason I was checking this was to see if there was any special plastic or plastic strip that has to be torn off to get the toner flowing. In this particular case, nothing like that. You just had to unlatch the toner from the drum and drop the new one straight in. However, as I said, once I'd done that, not only did I have the toner light on, I had all the lights on. So, again, I had to go to the web and figure out, oh, and I had this fusion error popping up in the error box. So I had to go onto the web and find out what to do about fuser errors. Well, Brother, which is the manufacturer, had a couple of things to do. One was just to basically switch off the printer and then turn it on again. So I did that a few times, but that didn't do anything. Then they had this interesting instruction, leave it running for 15 minutes with the power on. So I thought, well, that's a bit odd, but, you know, it's their instruction. So I left it on for 15 minutes, and sure enough, after about 15 minutes, the machine whirred and the lights mostly went out, and I was left with just the toner light on. So I'm still not able to print. Now, clearly, all these errors are something to do with replacing this cartridge. I can't believe there's anything wrong with the fuser. And now it has a full thing of toner, so it's highly unlikely. I mean, it's third-party cartridge, but it's still highly unlikely that the toner cartridge is empty. So I dug around on the web for a little while, and eventually I found a third-party website that told me I could reset the printer and basically tell it that it had a new cartridge. So it was a question of playing around with the various buttons, pressing go, don't collect $200, do this twice, all the lights. You know, you follow the instructions here, and basically once all the lights go out, then you're ready to print. So that worked really well. So then I basically printed these instructions, thinking that one of these days we have to replace this cartridge and we might have to do this thing again. And to my amazement, I found that I had black spots all over the page. I've got them highlighted here. And you can see basically that I've got the same pattern of two dark spots, and it's being regularly spaced up and down the page. So clearly this has got something to do with the paper going through the rotating drum, and toner is being deposited in places that it shouldn't be. Again, if you check on the web, you'll find that this occurs because there's a problem with the drum roller. Dirt or something has built up on the drum roller. It's holding on to toner where it shouldn't, and basically putting these marks on the page. So again, there are instructions on how to do that. And basically you'll separate the toner cartridge from the drum unit. And now we're going to play with this drum unit. We turn it upside down. This is the drum unit. It's kind of glass right here. And we can rotate it using this this gear cog. And we use isopropyl alcohol with a cloth and just basically clean the whole drum. And with a bit of luck, that will solve the problem. And sure enough, here's the piece of the page with the spots. And here afterwards, you'll see the same piece of page and no spots. So my $20 solution basically works quite well. And I noticed a couple of people in the chat window have given their input. Bill says his luck has been on Amazon as well. Michelin uses EnviroLaser on Colonnade Road for refills, so that's a third-party one. And Dan says he uses 123 Ink from Montreal, and always good and always cheap. And Greg wants to know if the drum is part of the cartridge or the printer. It's basically the whole cartridge. This unit right here, the toner cartridge clicks into the drum unit, and then you insert that whole unit, you insert that into the top of the printer, and that's basically where the paper gets fed through and printed.
My understanding, Alan, is that the drum unit, like normally it does not get replaced when you change the toner cartridge, but that, you know, it's at some point, maybe, you know, 1 in 10 times you change the toner cartridge, you also end up having to do the drum unit.
That's correct. My other laser printer, I've got two laser printers. My other laser printer is giving me the replace drum now message. However, it prints perfectly fine, so I'm not about to replace it yet. And the other problem is the drum unit is much more expensive than the toner cartridge.
Yeah.
So it's kind of at the point where you say, you know, do I buy a new drum unit for a printer that's several years old, or do I just go out and buy a new printer? Because the new printer is, you know, less than twice the cost of the drum unit.
Yeah.
So it's built-in obsolescence.
Yeah, it's really a shame. It's really a shame, I think, that manufacturers, you know, manage to do this where it's actually better for you to junk, you know, some huge piece of equipment, you know, and just buy something new. It's crazy.
Yeah, but it really is like, you know, that Right to Repair Act that people want, where they won't sell you the part to repair your gizmo.
Yeah.
So you have to go buy a new gizmo. It makes no sense. But the other thing is, I mean, you know, they talk about, for example, printer ink being the most expensive liquid on the planet.
Yeah.
You know, well, the toner is almost the same, right? $100 for something I can buy somewhere else for 20. That makes no sense.
Yeah.
It makes no sense. Anyway, there we go.
Yeah, a couple of comments.
Buy a new printer.
Yeah, we had a couple of comments. Elton thought it was an image of Mars and Jupiter coming close together. Greg wanted to know, were the comments on Amazon for this product reflecting your experience? So
yes, they were. There were quite a lot of comments about Ink First, and most of them were quite good. They had like a 80 to 90% approval rating. There were some that said, you know, don't touch this thing with a 10-foot barge pole. But for $20, it's worth a shot. And, you know, various people have commented that they found sources of third-party refills that have worked very well. So, personally, I've never had any problem using refilled cartridges.
For comments, that's one of the things I actually like about Amazon is that they have this verified purchaser. And so I'm always suspicious when I'm on a third-party site that I don't know and I see all kinds of positive reviews, whether it's for a restaurant or a toner cartridge, because you could have competitors that are putting up bad reviews or the company themselves posting glowing reviews, whereas at least on Amazon, you get that idea that this is somebody who has actually bought it through Amazon. And so you're not going to get very much of a competitor buying things just so that they can give trashy reviews or, you know, giving positive reviews. It's a pretty expensive way to put up a positive review or a negative review. So that's one of the things I do like about shopping on Amazon.
Well, I'm going to throw your head into a spin.
Oh, no.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I used an HP2 for many years that I got for nothing, and it was great, except for the paper jams. But when I finally had to toss it out because of the paper jams, I went to various inkjet printers, and as was mentioned, the darn ink cartridges, they'll bleed you dry. Anyway, a few years ago, here in Quebec, I was wandering through a store. It's called Rossy, R-O-S-S-Y. It's sort of a giant tiger kind of department store place, mostly clothing with various household stuff and minimal other things. And there was this laser printer for $80 sitting on a shelf beside the school supplies. And the product was called a Pantum. P-A-N-T-U-M, I think. Anyway, it was $80. I'm sitting there going, I spend that much in inkjet cartridges. What the hell? I bought it. And it turns out Pantum is actually a major commercial printer manufacturer, and this was just some sort of really inexpensive home use device that they also had. And it was a black and white only, simple laser printer that has given us almost no grief for about 4 years now. Interestingly, the department store, Rossi, they are the home company of Dollarama.
Oh, so it should have been a dollar.
It should have been a dollar, but but I think it's paid for itself more than over for what it was. Anyhow, being such an odd beast in such an odd store, we got it for a great price. And they had some backup cartridges available for $40 each. And then because nobody bought the things other than us, eventually the replacement cartridges went on sale and got marked down and discounted, and I think I got two of them for like $10 each, and I still haven't used any of them. The original cartridges, the toner cartridges, still in the machine. So I would suggest people look around for something other than HP or Canon or anything else. If you're just doing basic printing, you know, I would say 99% of what people do is black and white text printing. And we just buy these color all-in-one things, you know, because we want to do our own photographs at home. When actually, you just go to Walmart with your pictures on a on a flash drive, you can probably print your pictures on a professional Kodak machine for next to nothing, as opposed to buying a bloody all-in-one laser color printer.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah, the color printers are expensive, but again, you've got to buy multiple toner cartridges, which is the thing that kills you.
Yeah. Exactly. And like I said, you go to Walmart and they've got these massive kiosks where you can just plug in an SD card or a flash drive with your images on it.
It's not as good quality. I did a lot of printing of photos, and wow. I got caught once. My inkjet was down. And I used Walmart, and the quality was horrible compared to what I was used to, which wasn't, you know, the most expensive machine in the world. But yeah, be careful. It's the same like Shutterfly. I've got prints from them. It's good quality if you pay. If you get their free prints as a special, every now and then they'll have free prints. They're terrible.
Fair enough.
Well, it just depends what you want. If you're putting it on your wall, an 8x10 or something like that, don't go to Walmart. If you're just printing a 4x6 for your grandmother, that's great. But if you want a really good quality print, by all means, don't buy a printer, but go to a better
store. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We don't all need a professional office at home for something we use once every 6 months.
Yep.
Yeah, I think you're right. However, I actually like all-in-ones because not only can you print with all-in-ones, but you can also scan and you can make photocopies. So it's actually quite a useful tool. But again, I agree with black and white only. That makes a lot of sense.
If I could point out something, if you have a smartphone, you have a scanner.
Well, these days you do, right?
and it can be a little bit tricky doing a scanning with your phone, getting things squared up and everything like that. If you put it on a flatbed all in one, I mean, it's all going to be squared up and everything like that. So
again, it comes down to what quality is required.
Yep. Yeah.
So Bill makes a good point here. He says that watch for sales at places like Staples. You can get an excellent multifunction laser printer for $69, and he bought one. Yeah. And that's been my experience. When they're on sale, there are some really good deals.
Yeah, always.
I think your printer, Stuart, is probably Pantheon.
No.
Right? Because he found a site in Malaysia?
No, Pantone.
Okay, Pantone.
Pantone, P-A-N-T-U-M.
Yeah, okay, that's right. Greg's posted the link. It's global.pantheon.com.
Then the one model I found, like, it's a dollar store, for God's sake.
Yeah. I agree with the idea of not overbuying. So, you know, really, really do look critically at what your needs really are. And if you don't need a Cadillac,
I really don't need a Ferrari to go for groceries.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, moving on. We've got another reminder coming up from Chris.
Yeah, so don't forget September, the regular meeting for the OPCUG is our members' favorites. And so this is a 10 to 15 minute presentation. It could be anything you want to present on it. So it could be a program you like, a little utility. It could be a commercial program, just something that you want to share with other members to say, this, if you have a need similar to mine, you might find this useful, or something that you just find kind of neat about this particular program that you want to share with others. It could be a piece of hardware. So if it's a particular, a monochrome laser printer that you really like. Made by Pantone. You know, if you want to do a little presentation on it, I've done them on tablets. I've done them on old netbooks going back years and years ago. I've done it on drawing tablets and things like that. Or a service. So something that you came across, that a particular service that's available, you know, like tonight I gave a little presentation on that service for shrinking PDF files. You know, if you find a service like that or a company in town that you can walk into that, you know, they do great things and you want to share that information with others, 10 to 15 minute presentation on it, that'd be great. It can be just talking about things. It could be, you know, a slide deck. It could be a live demo of something, whatever you want to do, fill your boots. And this time is the first time ever you'll have a chance to win a 2 terabyte external hard drive. We'll have a live voting after all of the presentations at September meeting. And it's only the people eligible are non-board members, so just regular members. And we'll have a live vote, and we'll announce at that meeting. Whichever one is deemed to be the most popular by attendees will win the 2 terabyte external hard drive, and we'll figure out how we can get that to you at that time. So this is a chance for you to fulfill the motto of the user group, users helping users. And just some of the past things that we've had on members' favorites. So all kinds of topics that have been there, from operating systems to calendars to, you know, the running, you know, Mac rumor fuck backup software, streaming live TV, doing your taxes on OpenOffice, all kinds of topics that we've had in the past. That's probably about 50 to 75% of the topics that we've had at prior members' favorites. So we've had a lot of them. They're always a lot of fun. And as I said, it's your chance that you could actually win a 2 terabyte drive. So I would encourage everybody to jump forward on that. If you send in to suggestion box at opcug.ca, we'll reserve a spot for you. And do so soon. If we run out of time, we'll have to tell you sorry. You'll have to wait until the next opportunity to do a member's favorite. So I encourage everybody to participate in that.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And now it is time. If anybody has any other questions or things you'd like to share.
Yes, I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so I have Office 365. I don't remember. I think I got the account from somebody who was not using it. And now I'm getting the message we're having trouble verifying your Office 365 subscription status due to a network or temporary service issue. We'll keep trying. You can keep using Excel until July 31st. So I was just wondering, is it easy to switch? I have no problem purchasing the next subscription, but is there an issue to transfer to another email account, or should I be aware of details like that?
I'm just Googling it right now just to see if I see anything, but I suspect that it might be difficult to do transfer data between accounts, transfer Office to another account. So there is something that dates back to 2018 in Microsoft Answers. So let's just see if it seems to be doable. Any update? Incorrect MS account. It looks like you have to be able to log in to the original account.
Okay.
As a minimum. And so, yeah, they talk about signing in using the original account. I think if you don't have access to the original Microsoft account, you're going to be dead in the water.
Okay.
I just did a really quick search on that, so if anybody knows any other way, by all means, pipe in. I'm just going by the first hit that I found. And
I just asked in the chat and nobody's come back yet.
Yeah. One comment I see on this, on the Microsoft Answers forum is the inability to transfer products from one Microsoft account to another is very frustrating. I have several examples. So it looks like, you know, other people who have tried to do it, it's difficult.
What about the contact us thing on Microsoft's website?
That's certainly worth trying. If you go to, and you can actually access this locally. What is it? It's not the problem reporter. It's
Feedback Hub.
Feedback Hub, yeah. If you go into the Feedback Hub, you could actually do that, and you can actually talk to a person. So okay. If you go into Feedback Hub on your computer, and you can just put in anything and then just say, no, you haven't told me the right answer. And you have to tell them about three or four times that, no, you still haven't told me the right answer. And eventually they will give you the opportunity to talk to somebody at Microsoft. So you could go that route. If they don't present you with the answer saying, no, you're not allowed to do this, then you could end up talking with somebody. And I found them to be really good. When I did end up talking to somebody, they would very quickly get me the right answer that I was looking for. So that's a good suggestion there, Alan, to go through that.
It strikes me there's another way to do it, though. I forget. I think it might have been Michelin was trying to contact them. And I thought I found a website on the Microsoft Canada, a web page on the Microsoft Canada site that had either a phone number or an email or both that you could actually contact Microsoft directly.
Okay. This essentially will get you there. You just have to click about half a dozen times before you get to the point where they will actually let you talk with somebody. But it will work. I mean, you just have to keep telling them, nope, that doesn't solve my problem. Nope, that doesn't solve my problem. And then eventually they say, do you want to talk to somebody? And you say, yes. And you get put in the queue. And you're usually told you're number 14,375 in the queue. And within about 5 minutes, somebody will come on and actually talk to you. So it my experience has been very good at getting answers from them.
Okay. Thank you.
Do we have any other questions before we wrap it up for the evening? We somehow always manage to fill the hour. So this is pretty amazing.
Well, lots of people had information on laser printing,
yeah,
which is really good.
Some good, I really like
suggestions
that.
There. Okay, well, let's move along. I think we've only got one more slide. That's it. Yeah. So next week, August the 4th, will be our next question and answer session. As usual, if you have any questions or topics you want to share, and especially if you want to give a presentation at Members' Favorites Night in September, then send us something to suggestion box. And as William says, you can now get back to watching the Olympics. So thanks, everyone, for coming, and I hope you enjoyed it.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.